Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. Thank you for listening. This is episode number 337. This is a great episode. We have two segments on this episode. One is, I have the filmmaker John Neeland, who is a documentary filmmaker, who made a movie called Here Come the Video Freaks. And joining him, by the way, is not his co-director, Jenny Raskin, and it's unfortunate she couldn't be there for the conversation, but they made up for it in a sense because one of the original members of this alternative media video collective that was popped up in the 60s and 70s and was creating all this incredible content with very crude equipment, and they were not, you know, slick filmmakers, but they got together and they made all this stuff in order to present their own version of what was interesting and newsworthy, and they did this and had a great deal of success with it, in fact, back in the 60s and 70s. And one of the original 10 members, Skip Lumberg, will be on the episode also with, again, co-director John Neeland. Again, the name of the film is called Here Come the Video Freaks, V-I-D-E-O-F-R-E-E-X. And the film will be opening here in New York City this Wednesday, the 9th of March. And so I feel compelled to get this episode up and out. Also, the next segment is with the Filmwax Radio friend, Charlie Ahern. Charlie was on a very early episode of the podcast, probably in the first, 100 or so shows. I don't remember, but you can find it if you want to. But Charlie is best known for his feature film Wild Style, which was a seminal movie about graffiti and hip-hop and the B-boy crews and all that was going on in the city, and he made this wildly successful film. But he continues to this day making lots of films about, I would say, the hip-hop culture, street culture, the underground culture here in New York, and the Anthology Film Archives in the East Village is going to be programming a whole weekend, this coming weekend, of films by Ahern from past and present, and we're going to be talking about it at great length. I'll get you all the information on the show's notes. But essentially, this weekend, the 11th through the 13th, if you're in New York, you find yourself in New York, listen to this program that's coming up in just a minute with Charlie. Please, by all means, consider coming and to the theater and seeing some of his work. It sounds so fantastic. I kind of almost challenge you not to come once you hear the conversation, because it's just... I myself am licking my wounds, ladies and gentlemen, because I have to go to South by Southwest this week, and I will be missing this, and I'm really very, very disappointed that I will not be able to come. But let's get into this conversation with Mr. Ahern. Charlie's been around for so long, it's kind of ridiculous. He's made many, many short works and experimental works, but he's also made some amazing features and documentaries. The one that made a film called The Deadly Art of Survival, which was almost the prototype for Wild Style. Deadly Art of Survival came out in 1979. Wild Style was his follow-up in 1983. Most recently, a few years ago, he made a film, and this is when I met him. It was called Jamal Shabazz Street Photographer, and I saw that at BAM Cinema Fest, where I also, by the way, coincidentally happened to see Here Come the Video Freaks. The difference was just a couple of years, though. I saw Jamal Shabazz, the documentary, in 2013, I think it was, unless I'm mistaken. And then I just saw last summer, I saw Here Come the Video Freaks. So anyway, so I'm kind of throwing in a little bit of a plug to BAM Cinema Fest for showing great documentaries and films in general at that annual showcase. Charlie, I've known. I run into him frequently. I've gone to a number of different screening events with him. I'm a fan of his work. So let's go right now into my conversation with Charlie Ahern, and then I'll be back to introduce the second segment.
Let's do this.
So this weekend, you are going to be showcasing some material, right? Some new and some...
It's,
what's,
it's,
you tell
it's,
me.
Well, it I like to think of it as a kind of off the cuff, mini retrospective of things, but it's really not my feature work that's known to people. So it's lesser known work by me than feature films that I've done. So it's focusing primarily on a work that I did that I'm quite proud of in 1978, which was shot on Super 8 in the housing project where Lee Quinones, who's the star of Wild Style, the Smith Projects, which is north of the Brooklyn Bridge, but really, as he puts it, it connects to the whole lower deck of the Lower East Side. In other words, you go past where he lived and you see these, you once saw gigantic handball court murals stretching up Madison going north towards the Lower East Side as we know it. And I was working in that area from 1977 and 1978 primarily. Mm-hmm. And the making of this film, which is called The Deadly Art of Survival, undoubtedly is what led to making Wild Style. There could have never been a Wild Style without making this film first, primarily because my involvement in that neighborhood with Nathan Ingram, who's the he's the star of the movie, mm-hmm. And he is a heroic figure and well known in the neighborhood for having been the sifu of a martial arts school, which was very powerful in terms of helping young kids create an alternative focus in their life, a spiritual discipline. People saw the Bruce Lee, who had died a few years earlier, mm-hmm. hung over all the whole street culture, was infused by a kind of sense of awe about Bruce Lee, which is, I always found amazing to me, that kids from Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods were so focused on Chinese culture, but especially the Kung Fu movies were very, very powerful in terms of giving people a kind of street image, which they could both be entertained by, but also inspired by. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this movie, which was called The Deadly Art of Survival, we have worked, that is anthology, and I have worked for a year and a half to create a brand new, very high quality version of this movie, a digital version of the movie, going back to the original materials that the movie was shot on. And this was paid for by the Andy Warhol Foundation.
What's that?
The Andy Warhol Foundation funds a whole myriad of creative institutions and personalities to recollect work and refurbish and make a new work that is out there, because, you know, we have this particular grant was to work on movies from the 70s and early 80s that deserved attention, and movies can fall through the cracks,
yeah,
and disappear.
You think as many as there are, and that are keep coming, being found and whatnot, but that people don't have any idea necessarily of how many have been lost over the years.
Most of them are gone. Most of them, and in the case of this particular film, people have seen it in a smaller version. Let's say a version that was 60 minutes long. And it was on DV, which is very, like, not a great quality. And this is a version that will be 73 minutes long, mm-hmm. and much richer visually and the sound and everything. I think it's quite good. I'm not saying the movie is genius, but I'm saying that the quality of the film is good.
That's wonderful.
And it has. Not only the kind of look and feel of what housing projects and the culture in housing projects, that street culture, whatever you want to call it, the way people dressed. It was largely shot outdoors, and there are some amazing fight sequences. So there's plenty of action in this film, mm-hmm. and there's also some real views of, like, in a pool hall or a scene in the church, the Baptist church that Nathan's family ran on 14th Street. Mm-hmm. Is very much in evidence in this, and I think those are time capsules of a culture that has disappeared.
Totally. Is that the one that's across from Stuyvesant or Peter Cooper?
Mount Olive Church, it was called, and it was it was in the middle of 14th Street. I'm not sure exactly right. where, but the thing is that the film was shown. At the Times Square show, it was shown at the New Cinema, which was the sort of collab funded Eric Mitchell mm-hmm. organized showing where all the downtown Super 8 classic films from the late 70s were shown at this location in 1979. But it was also shown on in a large theater on Second Avenue, and we brought the entire school. We would travel with the school, like up to the Bronx to Fashion Moda and other places, where they would perform a live show, mm-hmm. which related a lot to what was happening in the film, and then we would show the movie, which was about 70 minutes.
That was my next question. Okay. And it is a little bit of a hybrid.
It's a hybrid exactly the way, this is what's interesting to me about it, is that it's a hybrid exactly the way Wild Style was a hybrid. Okay. In other words, I'm working completely with the kids in the neighborhood. Real characters that are in the story are playing themselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't tend to do outside casting, so-called. There's no actors in this film. Everything is shot in the real locations of the film around the Brooklyn Bridge, which was right where Lee Quinones lived at that time. And in many ways, it's kind of a shoestring version of what you see in Wild Style, without the going into the subway yards and seeing, you know, the great stuff happening in the clubs and that kind of thing. It's not the Bronx, it's the Lower East Side. But in a way, this is a picture of Lee Quinones' neighborhood, because Lee Quinones was actually a member of this school and knew all these people. And I found him. Mm-hmm. I found him while I was making the film. I was shooting a scene in front of one of his Howard the Duck mural, which later became famous. But at the time, he had just painted it in 1978. And I said, you've got to be in this film. And he just said, bet. And then he tooled off in his motorbike, and I wasn't able to find him after that. So there are many other films that are going to be shown at Anthology next weekend. And as you saw when you entered my space here, on the floor is a sizable pile of 16-millimeter film cans, mm-hmm. which are films which exist only in 16-millimeter. I've not seen these films since I made these films.
What?
In 1976 to 1978. I have not seen those films.
Have you spot-checked them for that they're okay, that they're in good shape, and, you know?
No,
okay.
I didn't, but we will.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is that I found them.
That you found them.
The important thing is that they are complete prints. You know, in those days, Super 8 and 16 millimeter, I was shooting with reversal and not using negative to shoot, which was the way film artists almost always have worked. Mm-hmm. Like Warhol always shot in reversal, and most people shot in reversal because you didn't have to deal with cutting negatives to see what your product is, or work prints and all these things, which were very time consuming and expensive.
So what is a reversal?
Reversal means that when you see the film come back from the lab, it's in the full color that you understand it to be and not a negative version of the color for printing purposes. Negative is for when you need to make lots of prints of your film.
Right.
So there are many other films that I'm going to be showing also. Besides these 16 millimeter films that are from really from the mid 70s, which I don't know. I think it's pretty, it's adventurous for me to show them to people without having to look at them myself. And they are narrative travel films that I made that are in a sense somewhat autobiographical. But kind of poetic and just what I think people, film artists, were doing in the mid-70s. You know, my generation that, you know, that started to make films in the mid to late 70s really started to move on making a kind of simple narrative film. You know, Amos Poe and the Beat. You know, Scott
F.B.
Right. I think there was a turning away from more abstract or poetic kind of filmmaking and more towards kind of a pop, like a super shoestring pop aesthetic, which was to make a genre film like this Kung Fu movie is a genre Super 8 feature of a Kung Fu movie. But it's not. It's also a kind of, it was also an art film made for that context. So all of those films were really art films. They weren't real
genre films.
Gotcha. They were playing at being genre films. Other films that I'm going to be showing are my two films that I made when I moved to Times Square. And I made two films there really in the mid to late 80s. This was after I had my first child with Jane Dixon, and after Joe was born, I got myself one of these, what they called 8mm video cameras, which were very easy to use and shot sound and picture together. And At the time, I really had missed Super 8 filmmaking, because once you get away from Super 8 and you're into 16 millimeter, it becomes much more complicated with crews and budgets and a lot of other things. And I missed that, and I started to shoot a lot of video. And when I was in Times Square living with Jane for all those years, we lived there for 12 years, right on the corner across from Show World in Times Square. And there was stuff going on every night of the week.
Yeah, it was like a
I would
a
be
whole...
in the middle of the night, I would hear, bitch, you know, and someone would throw
a
garbage can and it would be, you know,
right.
People were getting decked and there was drug deals
shot
and
it.
There was, yes, and I shot this. I shot this out my window.
Yeah.
Whatever was going on. And because it was really my home movie reels, I was shooting my children's birthdays and my children doing things, and then I'd be shooting something at night. And I had this experience of showing people when they'd come over, like, oh, there's my son's birthday. Oh, here comes, you know, there's some transvestites throwing garbage cans
at
the police.
Cop. Yeah.
And so it wasn't until after years of doing this that it occurred to me, oh, this is actually a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very embarrassing at first to imagine your home movie as a movie. But the more I thought about it, I thought, no, this is a really interesting genre kind of putting my interest in the street culture together with my actual domestic real life. And I made that and finished it and shown it at the New York Film Festival in 1991. Was when the final film was shown, and I immediately started shooting. I was shooting films with my wife Jane, because she was looking at this video work that I was doing. She was making paintings of it, and then I was looking at what she was doing, And honestly, all along, I was really inspired by Jane's vision of looking out the window and making paintings and art from things that that you could see out our window. Like there was this, a block away, you could see this white-haired prostitute that was always out there right at about 8 o'clock when as soon as it would get dark, this white-haired prostitute would appear under this light. And it was very visible. And she made several paintings of this. And that became iconic to where we were living in the world that we were living in. And so in a sense, it was a collaboration with Jane mm-hmm. to make more of this film and to connect it to her artwork. And I called that Jane in Peepland. It was my new installment of what was going on. And then we left Times Square to come down to Tribeca. And that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. And I made lots of films with other artists that I was working with. Like I made a film with my twin brother, John. Mm-hmm. I made a film with Kiki Smith. I made a film, it's called Kiki in the Flesh. Mm-hmm. And a film with Tom Otterness. And a film which a lot of people have seen quite a bit, which is a film with Martin Wong. And that's been seen all over, that people are quite taken by that. Mm-hmm. These are not being shown at...
Okay,
these,
that was my next.
Yeah, what I was trying to say is that my Times Square movies that I made, Doing Time in Times Square and Jane in Peepland, will be shown at Anthology... on Saturday night.
Oh, very good.
That will be an amazing program.
Yeah. And
so on Saturday, we're going to have these mm-hmm. 16 millimeter films for a 6 o'clock program. And then in the evening program will be the Times Square movies. And then we move on to Sunday, which was my day, because I'm really happy and excited to show people all the hip-hop related films that I've been doing. Like in the past 10 years, I've made probably 20 films. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that I make these films, but they're very, very contemporary, dynamic. Some of them are quite shocking for people to see. I like to think of like what I do with film is kind of like stage diving into the content.
Mosh pit. Into the mosh pit of content.
Yes, the world in which I'm working with, and there are these moments where the whole thing just opens up, and I'm like no longer even there. I'm just in it, and it's happened a couple times recently, and I'm working on doing something tomorrow and in 2 weeks. Uh-huh. So there's a lot coming up. And what this has to do with is work related to the subway. Mm-hmm. And I've been shooting on the subway a lot. I did something about a week ago on the subway that was really interesting. There was kind of a flash mob on the subway with a beatboxers and MCs and some dancers. And tomorrow I'm planning to go out to the Q train mm-hmm. with a group called the Waffle Crew. And we're having our meeting on the Q train, which I think is really an interesting idea because that's their workplace and studio.
In transit.
On a moving train, yeah.
The other day when you went and you shot something, you said also on the train, right?
Yeah,
on the subway
I went to something that was already organized by Kid Lucky, and they do an annual kind of beatbox cipher on the this one was on the J train. Mm-hmm. Which is one of my favorite trains for seeing performance.
just in the spontaneity of being on it, and there's something happens, or like,
well,
something
it's,
where
it's certain
you, it's
trains
more planned than
real, certain trains really have action on them, and the Q train, the Waffle Crew really likes the Q train because the center posts, the metal poles that mm-hmm. people, and they do call it pole dancing. It's really funny, but they right. but they are not in the center, but they are on the sides,
like staggered.
Staggered yeah. on the sides, so that there is more room for real
momentum.
Some things to be done down the middle of the train, which is more showtime
right.
than ever. So that is the reason. And so I'm hoping to go there tomorrow
so
on the Q train.
Okay. But the Waffle Crew?
Waffle Crew is not a group that I've worked with. They are a group that we're discussing doing something soon.
But what do they do?
The Waffle Crew are famous as light feet dancers. They are famous for having spearheaded the phenomenon of dancing on trains, ostensibly for change, for money that people would give them. They have become world famous. They have traveled all over the planet doing what they do. They're professional in a sense. They are a crew of anywhere from 5 to 12 people, and they are developing new moves, and what they do relates to past dance forms, like mm-hmm. let's say what was called b-boying.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call it breakdancing. These worlds intersect. Like, there's street dancers that mm-hmm. perform in Washington Square or by the Brooklyn Bridge or by the Battery, for example, but all over the world. And they connect different kinds of dancing. If you see these street dancers, they will have some of the kind of acrobatics that were famous in the late b-boying phase. Early b-boying was not so much acrobatics. It was more floor dancing that is close to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But then people became incredibly good at, let's say, backflips and on one hand and things like that.
Were
tremendous.
Yeah.
That were very show-stoppy kind of moves that would get people to applaud.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, it's about music and dancing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I also know that when I think about it, I realized having riding out to Queens a lot on the express trains, which go out towards Forest Hills, where there's these long, like you go by literally, the express will skip 5 stops, and it gives the showtime guys, it gives them a significant amount of time to perform. So they really like that train. So they'll go to, there's 2 long express.
Which train is that?
E or F train. They both make these 2 yeah. very long, 5.
I'll have to try these out.
Yeah, you should, because they both, any day. There's 2 express stops, one between Queens Plaza and Roosevelt, Jackson Heights,
yeah.
which is, skips like 5 locals. And then there's another one from, the next one, which is from Jackson Heights to Forest Hills, again, skipping like 5 local stops. So those 2, and then they'll just turn around at Forest Hills and go back. Because
okay. There is a film that I made recently in Coney Island. There's a film that I made in Paris
mm-hmm.
where, I was invited, to go into the Paris Metro late at night after it had closed, with a graffiti artist who frequents the Metro at night. And I went down with him, and he painted several trains, which took about 4 hours down in the Metro, getting chased by people. And the film is pretty amazing, and it looks gorgeous because I shoot with this little Canon camera that is so light. I put it in my pocket, but it shoots great HD video, and it sounds beautiful. So
do you just shoot? So you're the crew?
I am the crew. Well, you couldn't have a crew in this situation.
No, of course not. Right.
This is dangerous,
right,
late at night. It's hard enough for me to be down there. But I've shot, like, the Coney Island film, which I shot largely with this camera and with a friend of mine, Art Jones, who
yes, I know Art.
Works with me with a lot of my films. And there's a film that I shot on the Brooklyn Bridge with a brass band and a whole crew of MCs from Brooklyn called mm-hmm. the 9/11 crew.
Mm-hmm.
So this is fresh for most people, and it's hip hop.
Yeah. So you've kind of been committed to shooting this culture for decades now.
Like yeah.
Going
I
on
mean,
four
it's,
decades,
it's,
really.
It's,
I mean,
it's keeping me young.
It is. You look younger than ever. It's disturbing almost. So Friday is going to be...
Friday is the Deadly Art of Survival.
Deadly Art
Super
Survival.
8, and then Saturday
and then
is
Saturday,
the 16mm program at 6.
Followed by the Times Square stuff as the headliner, if you want to call it that. And then
yes.
Sunday is your more, let's say, the last 10 years.
My recent stuff, which is the 16mm, which is the... I liked it. It's really digital media. You can't call it video.
Gotcha.
But it's HD digital media hip hop films that I've done in the last couple of years.
Right.
And then we end the program with another screening of The Deadly Art for those who couldn't get into the first screening because it's a small theater.
Go. That's great. Oh, they're showing it upstairs?
They're showing it at the Maya Deren room, which is my favorite room. It's really
it's
warm.
Stadium seating, by the way.
It's a warm, great, yeah. It's a great seating, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that film. The theater is really my theater.
So go, that's the 11th?
The 11th is Friday.
12th and 13th of
12th
March.
And 13th, yeah.
Okay, great.
And
it's exciting, Charlie.
It's not a retrospective. It's just some sampling of things that are really, most of it is from what I would call the distant past. But I'm happy to show it to people.
And yourself, apparently.
And I will, of course, be there.
Right.
And I like to say some things to people while, you know, to tell some stories because all this stuff goes with amazing stories. And, of course, we could get into some of those stories here because we have a few minutes, right?
Yeah.
Not too many minutes, no.
No, I mean, it's up on the East Village.
So what do you have any questions about this?
Well, I mean...
One of the things that I'm showing in the, you know, that I'm really most excited about showing this recent work because a lot of people haven't seen it or know about it. And I could go through some of the things that will there's a film called the Five Grandmasters, which relates to the kung fu movies of the 70s vis-a-vis the whole b-boy culture. Really, much of the b-boy culture was highly influenced by kids going to 42nd Street and slipping into movie theaters and staying, you know, all night watching kung fu movies. On 42nd Street, there was like the Mad Monkey Kung Fu, 18-pole diagram. There was the Seven Grandmasters film. You know,
so there wasn't just porn. There was also probably more.
I think
Kung
the
Fu
street
stuff.
Culture of 42nd Street was largely action movies, which Kung Fu movies were a big part of.
Sure,
and they were. Cheap for these theaters to the theaters rolled them back. It was a rep theater for street culture, if you get what I mean. It's the only rep theater for street culture that was, as far as I knew, in America, because you could go to 42nd Street at any time during day or night and watch movies that were so much a part of street culture.
Also black exploitation films too, right?
Which some black of that. Absolutely black exploitation films were very much a part of it.
They took place in Harlem, but you were watching them in 42nd Street.
Yeah, but the thing is that kids would come in crews, you know, not gangs, crews. In other words, they would show up with seven or eight of them, and they would, you know, one of them would get in and open up the back door, and their friends would get in. And when you sat in the theater, like. your feet would like be glued to the floor because there was so much spilled like Coca-Cola on the floor.
Right.
It was like a glue.
Everybody was hoping it was Coca-Cola.
And people were smoking reefer
right, sure.
in the theater
right.
and cigarettes, of course, but mostly reefer. And there was, of course, loose popcorn everywhere, which the rats loved. So there was rats scurrying underneath your feet. And I was a pig in shit. That's all I can say. That was my idea of a rep
Kevin?
Theater.
Oh, right.
I loved going there, and I studied those films. Obviously, when I was making The Deadly Art of Survival, that's when I really started, which was, you know, we're talking 1977, 1978. I started going to 42nd Street and started picking my ears up and hearing, you know, what people were saying to the movie screen. Talking back to the movie screen was part of
and informed the dialogue that was appealing to you,
yes.
that you wanted to put together stories that kind of use dialogue like that.
And I started to imagine them as an audience for my own films.
The
people that I'm sitting there,
right.
even though I didn't know them,
yeah.
I started to fantasize, oh, when I make a film, I'm going to bring it here. And when, you know, as soon as I started to work with Fab Five Freddy and Lee Quinones on Wild Style,
mm-hmm.
my fantasy right from the beginning was to bring Wild Style to 42nd Street and then just play it as a rep theater. In other words, bring it back every 3 months
mm-hmm.
on to 42nd Street, because, you know, it wasn't about, you know, usual theaters are called first run,
mm-hmm.
and it comes out with the big advertisements and everything, and then it's gone and it disappears at that time, because this is
right.
before the internet,
before VHS,
video,
right.
VHS.
Yeah.
Films disappeared.
Right.
And the only rep theaters would show West Side Story.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
or film noirs. But here was a rep street that was showing my favorite films. And of course, you know,
so later, it was also a preservation. It was also like a means of preservation of the film too. But what was the impetus for the, you know, I guess, I don't know, distributors or whoever
making
to
money
keep
was
the films
the
around, keep
making
copies
the,
because
the,
you're like you said, they disappear. So they didn't conceive of
right,
VHS
they would destroy
and home
those
video
film.
Yet.
Those films
yeah.
would be destroyed because
yeah.
you'd make, you know, 50 copies of a film and where
yeah.
to put all these films.
Right.
So, but the Kung Fu movies went from theater to theater and were on rotation, and they were probably bad prints that were
sure,
very beat up.
Right.
And I just thought it was fascinating because when you watch Mad Monkey Kung Fu, for instance, one of my favorite films, you see the blueprint of hip hop in the sense that it's about style and it's about form and it's about having high extreme skills at your discipline, whether your discipline is kung fu or rapping, or if your discipline is b-boying on mm-hmm. the on the street or in clubs or DJing. They battled. All these people were into the battle.
Right.
And the battle would have a winner. And these kung fu movies, the ones that I really loved, were not like massively violent. They were really studies in form mm-hmm. and studies in discipline. And the best players in these films were people with incredible kung fu skills who would be, you know, waged against opponents, and the one with the most skills would win in the end. Of course, he would be the only one alive, but still, there's different kinds of ways of,
yeah.
of competing. So the whole battle culture of hip-hop comes out of this idea.
It's a sociology lesson.
No, it's not.
A little bit.
Life lesson.
All right.
We're anti-academic
about it.
We are not academic here.
I understand. We're just down in the sticky Coke and popcorn.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So again, film at the Anthology Film Archives this weekend. Go immerse yourself in
the
all
sticky,
things
in the
sticky and loose popcorn. And
we're
we'll
hoping
bring the,
to release a few rats,
into the for the real, what do they call the authentic experience?
It is about having an authentic cinema
true.
Experience.
Right.
And the thing that makes it really authentic is the people in the room.
And you'll meet Charlie, and maybe other friends of yours will be there. I don't know.
I think they will be there.
Yeah.
I'm inviting them.
So they'll show up.
Yes.
I've been to a couple of your events, and people do show up, your friends. And
yeah, absolutely. It's a
scene.
That's
nice. That's great. Just blocks from where all of it took place.
Yes, yes, y'all.
Thanks, Charlie.
You kids get to bed, I get the storybook. Y'all tucked in? Here we go. Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, where laws were stern and justice stood, and people were behaving like they ought to good, there lived a little boy who was misled by another little boy, and this is what he said. Me and you tonight, we're gonna make some cash, robbing old folks and making the dash. They did the job, money came with ease, but one couldn't stop, it's like he had a disease. He robbed another
stick
and another,
stick
and a sister and a brother. Tried to rob a man who was a DT undercover. The cop grabbed his arm, he started acting erratic, he said, keep still.
Hey, I'm Monty Hellman, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Do you remember a time when sleeping on the floor with your friends wouldn't have been considered weird? The management of this website invites you to a new dimension in podcasting. An experience so fun, it can only be compared to a childhood sleepover. It's not just about horror.
Tom Atkins proves that any man is leading man material.
It's not just about action.
If you're going to rank Van Damme movies,
yeah, it's up there.
I'd put it top five.
It's not just about comedy.
There's no other person in the world that loves Weekend at Bernie's more than you.
It's not just about science fiction.
And you scrim with, like, a beautiful comb over.
It's about nostalgia. Can you survive the Saturday night movie sleepover? It's not a movie. It's a podcast about movies.
You can follow Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. That's SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. On Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher.
Okay, once again, John Nealon is the co-director of this film. Here Come the Video Freaks. It's going to be playing at the Angelica Cinema. Hey, by the way, just a few blocks from the Anthology Film Archives. You could actually make a day of it. You could go to see some Charlie Ahern. You can go to see Here Come the Video Freaks. Yeah, what a nice little synergy there. The film, again, is co-directed by John Nealon, who will be joining me in this conversation now. And unfortunately, Jenny Raskin, his co-director, couldn't be there. But we're joined by one of the original 10 video freaks, and his name is Skip Blumberg. He wants me to be very careful not to mispronounce it as Bloomberg, because he doesn't want to be associated with another New Yorker named Bloomberg. But Skip Blumberg will be joining us, and he was a charming man, and he had some great stories to tell and memories to share. So let's get into this segment with John Nealon and Skip Blumberg.
Parents of the past generation have done a shitty job, and the kids know it.
I know it's running.
I know it's running.
Well, the summer of 69, there was a feeling that anything was possible.
I knew there were other people who had video equipment.
It was new. It was breakthrough.
We really need is a revolution. We really got to overthrow the country. So we want money, we want guns, we want dynamite, lollipops, acid, dope, everything.
We want to have control over our own bodies and our own destiny.
We know that once the people are armed, those people cannot be oppressed.
Up the stairs came this guy in a suit and tie.
CBS was the most powerful network. I thought the Video Freaks had a life force.
We were radicals, but we were working for CBS.
I thought it was a total corruption.
All right, so we're here and we're live. Here Come the Video Freaks is the name of the film, the documentary that we're talking about today. It's going to have its New York City theatrical premiere beginning March the 9th, you said, right?
Yep.
John Nealon, who is half of the directorial team. Jenny Raskin, who is the other half, is not with us today, unfortunately, but here in spirit.
Yes.
Also joining us is Skip Blumberg, not Bloomberg, one of the Video Freaks. Thank you for participating in
Thank
the conversation.
Thank you, Adam. Really happy to be here and let people know about this great movie.
The movie, and also we'll dig in a little bit into also the subject, because that isn't, you know, why there is a movie. And for many people, and I'm going to guess a good substantial part of the people that are listening, maybe weren't even...
They weren't born.
Sparks.
They may not have been born.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a polite way to say I certainly was, I should say. As I was passing some sort of marker on the street in front of one of the buildings, it said September 10th, 1963 on it. And I was saying, oh, I was like 2 weeks from being born. And then also there's a new series called 1125, is it? 1122? 1122-1963. It's the name of the show. On Hulu or something. It's, of course, the Kennedy assassination took place on that day, so it's all about that. But, and I was, oh, it's 2 months old.
Yeah. I thought you were going to start talking about sex, which would get our audience's attention.
Yeah.
But you have to mention the word sex. You can't be, you know,
yeah, right.
Polite.
Oh, you're right. But I do think that the title gives a subliminal, sexy kind of suggestion, you know, because Video Freaks has an X at the end.
And the X.
Yeah. Yeah, see? There's a subliminal thing. If you could have added a second accent.
Can we start this show again? Never mind. All right.
No, let's get into the subject. Skip, you are one of the Video Freaks.
Yes.
And how many?
Well,
give it a little background about it.
There were 10 founding
members. Hold the mic. You hold it and just hold it close to your...
There were 10 founding members to the Video Freaks, but really there were probably 50 people who worked with us over the 9 years that we were in existence. We formed at Woodstock. Two of the members met each other, and one more was added, and then, which was real the beginning, was really the first Video Freaks project.
Uh-huh.
It was the Woodstock Music Festival.
At the actual...
At the festival, but the
Music and Crafts Festival.
Well, all right, let's talk about the gear. In other words, there was no video... until 1965 when, or 63 or something, when big quad equipment allowed recording TV shows other than by film. But it wasn't until the late 60s that, maybe quad was in the 50s, but the late 60s, mm-hmm. Sony and Panasonic introduced what they called consumer video, which were reel-to-reel recorders with a separate camera, and of course you could put a mic into that too. But they weighed about 16 pounds, the recorders, and the cameras weighed 6 more pounds, and you had to, they were reel-to-reel, so you had to thread them. So they really didn't take off. The intention was consumers or businesses or education market, but they were bought but generally kept in the closet because...
They were impractical.
They were hard to mess with. And they were picked up by artists and activists because at that time, you'll have to remember that there was no internet. There was the very beginning of cable TV, so there was no public access, no MTV.
No PBS.
Public television was a group of separate stations that were educational, but television was the most popular source of entertainment and news in America at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognized, the people that first picked up this gear recognized the power of television, and suddenly it was in our hands. At first, we just covered the alternate culture, because at the same time that there was this oligarchy of three TV networks, there was also the Vietnam War was going on, there was the peace movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and there was a lot of protest going on. In addition, there was the alternate culture, so people were experimenting with underground radio and alternate press and education and architecture, and there was a parallel universe of institutions going on, and we were like the TV network for the alternate culture. So we started making videos about, and we called them videos at that time, not movies.
Mm-hmm.
and we made.
But this is another way to distinguish yourself from the rest of the visual culture that was out there.
Well, for 40 years, video and film were separate mediums,
right?
And now they've combined. And I'm called a filmmaker, which I don't mind. And filmmakers use digital cameras. There's no such thing really as video anymore. The video signal is gone.
Right.
But in TVs, recordings, it doesn't exist. But it's like saying dialing a phone. There's no dial on a telephone anymore, but you still say dial.
Right.
So video still exists in our nomenclature. And then after a while, we started making videos about mainstream America. We covered with TV, the 1972 Republican and Democratic National Presidential Conventions. And we started getting on television, on Westinghouse broadcast stations, and then on PBS stations. And our work was seen by millions of people at the same time, which was very thrilling to know that in my hands I had several million people, viewers, eyeballs, looking at what I was looking at that moment. So it was really, really fun. And there were no teachers. We were not trying to make cheap films. We were exploring what was unique about this new medium of video that could be recorded endlessly, little money, that could be played back, and various other differences from film. And we were exploring that as an art form and making art and also documentaries.
So, thank you. And so going back a little bit now to the beginning, though, well, John, since you're passing the mic to John, we could actually, just to break things up, why don't we we'll talk to John for a little bit too. And when did the Video Freaks come onto your radar? When did you first hear about them, and the idea of making a documentary about them? When did that come about?
Yeah, I made a film in the early 2000s called Goodbye Hungaria, which was a shortish, about an hour long film about refugees. Mm-hmm. And the first time I showed it was in Socrates as part of the Woodstock Film Festival.
Oh, sure.
A screening series. It wasn't the festival. It was like a special series. And it was like February.
Off during the year, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Right. And it was actually the first time we ever showed it. And in the audience was Bart Friedman, one of the Video Freaks. And he was at that time a friendly guy, and came up and said, "Hey, you want to get a drink and talk about filmmaking?" And so we did. I was with Jenny at the time, and we started chatting with Bart, and he told us this story of the Video Freaks that sounded somewhat fantastical. Woodstock, CBS, pirate television, all the elements of the story.
We had a pirate television station near to Saugerties, New York, for several years, where we transmitted.
That's part of the film. And so anyways, Bart told us this story in a very entertaining way, and a day or two later, Jenny and I kind of said, "That sounds like a real great story. It sounds like a movie."
Something was your filmmaker.
Yeah, we're a film. We're filmmakers. We hear a great story.
Right, the hair is starting to
tingle.
So we said,
"Well, maybe we should look into this. Maybe Bart can send us a tape or two, and we should see if any of that footage really exists, and if this story is even true, because it sounded somewhat fantastical."
What year was that?
This was 2004.
That was
12 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it's premiering March.
Now it's premiering in a few weeks. Yeah. Yes.
And at the IFC Center, thank you for that. Yeah. It'll be on a March 9th at the IFC Center.
1 week at the 9th. Hopefully even longer, potentially.
Right. You'll see. We'll see. Come to the theater. That's the whole idea here.
So we started looking at these videotapes, a couple at first, and we were kind of, blown away by the quality. Not exactly the visual quality,
right.
the quality that we were, the feeling
content.
Of this content
was going into it. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was like nothing we'd ever seen from the 60s, and the way the quote unquote 60s are often portrayed these days, and 70s. Mm-hmm. Sure. And so we said, maybe this could be a movie. And we just kind of slowly dug in. We saw more tapes. We met more video freaks. We had more phone conversations, and then you know, one of the unfortunate things is that these video formats onto which most of this stuff was recorded are long defunct. So there
obsolete,
were...
As an obsolete, you mean?
Totally obsolete,
the,
yeah.
That would play, just the machines that would play them back.
Yeah, no one has them, or there are very few around. You can't just find one and stick one of these tapes in the tape deck because it'll fall apart. There's all kinds of technical reasons. And at around the same time, the Video Freaks happened to be finally kind of getting all their tapes back together, which had been kind of scattered to the wind to a certain extent.
Are you saying that, like, we're gathering them together?
Physically,
getting them all from...
In one place.
Existed in different spots.
Right, right.
Well, the group kind of faded out in 1978, and all of our tapes were distributed to different members, attics and closets and basements, and...
The storage.
Yeah, and right. Then the video data bank, vdb.org, at the Art Institute of Chicago got interested in this archive of all these videos about the 70s.
Sure.
And I'll add to what John said, and that is that in screenings that we've had over the years, recent years, before this movie was made, audiences of younger people really respond to the tapes because there's a freshness in them. There's a kind of inept technical quality, a skill level of our shooting, but that adds only integrity to integrity and believability in seeing this world, this utopian world from the 1970s, filmed from inside. It wasn't like we were making documentaries about something alien to us.
Right.
We were making it from being members of this community, and there's a freshness to it, and dynamic and liveliness. And audiences respond just to our raw tapes. There was a screening in Brooklyn. What's the name of that place? I forget. In downtown Brooklyn.
Not Brick.
No. Anyway, you know, and people sit there for hours looking at these raw tapes of ours. Now John and Jenny have made a fabulous edit, better than anything actually that we made ourselves, about our videos that highlight like 100 of our tapes, you know, are seen in this video.
Yeah.
And a lot of the documentary is when we were young and cute and
Skip's still cute. Oh, we'll put just for the record.
And Adam, you're cute. You're handsome.
Thank
you're
you. You're handsome. All right. And well, John, I prefer that.
I don't want to leave you out.
John's operating.
You're a movie star, John.
But John has the George Clooney kind of.
But in any case, John and Jenny rely a lot, you know, on telling our story through our own footage, and so you're seeing it from a first-person point of view.
Skip,
from inside.
You skip. So there's an unattended wall. That's probably not the right thing term, but I'm going to say when a filmmaker makes a film, it's presented to an audience. They come see. They pay. They come see the film. That's the nature of the relationship. It goes back, you know, 100 plus years now. What you're talking about is a different thing where this is us. We're all doing this. We're on the inside of this. We're just making these things. And that wasn't the intention for them to be necessarily. In other words, I guess the idea was to capture the for the pure joy and the pure motive inspiration. You were capturing all the things that you were shooting. There wasn't some big conventional system for this all this stuff when you were doing it. So
right.
You know, I think that's part of what people are getting. It's like. It's not performative. It's not meant to be edited and documented.
Some of it is performative.
I mean, it became, I'm sure,
art,
evolved.
Some of
right.
It is,
yeah. Okay.
Documentary. But you're hitting on something. It was an ecstatic experience to be in control of this powerful medium.
Right.
And we just shot.
Do you know
we didn't have much
time?
Money, but we had a rule where you could shoot as much tape as you wanted to, and that was like unlimited.
A little bit of math, a little bit of copper wire.
We were going to transmit to the people.
Well, what's happening right now is something new and something astounding.
Do you have any ideas about what we can do with this television station? It's your television station.
Meaningful work is more satisfying than money.
I saw a flying saucer.
We looked up and there I was. And then we fainted.
A lot of people said in the early days that the video freaks could be one of the signposts toward a future in which we all have video cameras. Now I see it came true.
So you probably don't even know how many sheer hours of content you guys have.
They do know, Skip, and everybody.
It's all been logged.
What's currently at Video Data Bank and a few other places. But like I said before, you can't just pick one of these reels up and put it in the deck. So.
Understood.
There's about 100 now that have been restored.
Okay.
John and Jenny restored many of the videos that we made about ourselves for this movie. And in addition, over the years, since we've been reformed as the Video Freaks Partnership at VDB.org, we have restored videos of Fred Hampton, who was a Black Panther, who we interviewed 3 months before he was murdered by the police and the FBI, of Abbie Hoffman, of Woodstock. So we've managed to restore another 50 or so, I think, videos that are available at VDB, and you could see little clips if you go to their site, and you can go to the Video Freaks, Video Freaks, VideoFreeks.com, one word, to see, to access clips and information about us, and it also gets, there's a link to VideoFreeksFilm.com, which is John and Jenny's movie about us.
Oh, right. So you have your own website, then there's the documentary that's coming out, and then there's the archive. What if people want to see, like, more extensive footage or the works?
VDB, they would go through VDB to see what's available. VDB.org. That's in Chicago, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or they can get in touch with me directly, skipblumberg.com, because I've re-edited some of the tapes, sort of digests of a lot of the videos, at least a dozen, where they could see, you know, user-friendly versions of these videos.
And, of course, you know, calls to mind, I mean, it brings up all sorts of questions like, well, what was this process of meeting everybody and getting together and figuring out, you know, like what you were going to shoot and where you were going
to
do that. But all that's kind of covered in the movie.
You have to see the movie. And to see the radical politics, the rock and roll. They left out the sex for some reason. I advised putting sex in, but they...
Bonus content.
Drugs, you know, alternate culture, performances, video art. It's all in the movie. It's a fast-paced film. I had advised them also to concentrate on two or three people, and I have to say, seeing it again last night at a preview at IFC Center, they really introduced...
At the Stranger Than Fiction? Was that Stranger Than Fiction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They really managed to introduce 9 out of the 10 people in substantial ways, where you get to know 9 out of the 10 founding partners of Video Freaks.
Who's the 10th person?
Annie is seen and talked about, but she's shy.
I see.
She was shy then, and she's still shy about being on camera, so I don't think she
minds. So there were 10 founding people?
There were 10 founding people, but like I say, there were so many people who, because in those days, I mean, we were a collective that stayed together for 9 years, which
it's
is
amazing.
Amazing to me, too, being in there, because there were 10 lunatics, and to keep together.
Yeah.
And I ascribe that to the fact that we had respect for each other, that we had separate domains, that we sort of soar over. Everybody had different responsibilities to have it. And people, since they respected each other, let us take care of those separate domains on our own. And we were all very productive. There was not a lazy person. We liked to make movies. And so we had very few meetings, because meetings to us were ways to avoid work. And the real work was getting things done. And that was to make videos.
There you go.
I want to just add in something here about the film, because I think one of the things that we discovered as we were looking through this footage, I said before how once we saw the footage, we kind of really opened our eyes to it, and the more footage we saw, the more we realized this was going to be a film. And then when we actually started really going forward and making the film and spending money, raising money and spending money on more restoration, because that was really the bulk of the filmmaking, was was the discovery process of what was in these tapes when we got really deep into it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a point at which we realized... maybe we didn't realize it at first, but that this film is about more than just the Video Freaks. I mean, it is their story, and that's how we that's the plot of the movie. But the film, and I think the reason why it's successful is that it's more like it's the story of a generation, and the Video Freaks are the representatives of that, because they were, you know, there's some forest, there's a lot of Forrest Gumpy kind of things happening where the Video Freaks are. You know, right
just
at the center of it,
at all these different seminal,
yeah, events. Right. It was like, it was an amazing time, and they were right in all the right places.
You see the scene from Born on the 4th of July of Ron Kovic screaming, sure, "Stop the bombing!" on the floor of the Republican convention. You see Ron Kovic doing it. The same scene that Oliver Stone reproduced.
Like
he looked at our video and he reproduced it. But
oh, okay.
You know,
well,
the
I'm a big fan of Ron Kovic's.
Aha, uh-huh, right. He's
I'd
a friend.
I'd love to get him on here.
You know, the movie is about... The story of the Video Freaks is in the film, you know. So let's concentrate on the mega issues. And I think the film is about three forms of community. It's about us as a group and our community. It's about our interactions with the Lanesville community when we had this pirate TV station in a small town of backwoods people who were suspicious of us at first.
Yeah.
But because we started broadcasting shows about them, we became very quickly part of the community that were appreciated.
They saw that you were... doing good work.
And yeah, including them in it. You know,
yes.
We were a consensus-based organization, and so we are consensus with our subjects as well.
And you gave them a TV station.
And we gave them their own TV station in a valley that had very little TV. It was only from rabbit ears then, and they only got one channel from Scranton, Pennsylvania, in upstate New York.
Wow.
And it's about the movement. And this is really the bigger issue, and that is we were part of a movement. We were part of many movements in those days. We were part of, like, the media, progressive media, but we were also part of the women's movement, the civil,
sure,
rights movement, the anti-war movement.
Sort of in the... Right in the vortex.
And people, you know, felt hope in those days and part of something bigger than themselves,
yeah,
part of not being isolated on their screen in their home looking at Netflix or Vimeo on demand. But
I'll have to edit that part out. Just kidding.
And emailing each other.
Yeah.
But there were frequent events to bring masses of people together to,
sure,
be part of something bigger. And now, you know, Bernie Sanders is not enough to bring change in America, to change the corrupt political system. Bernie Sanders, to be effective, has to bring along Congress and protesters on the street and to create enough excitement to do that. And with or without Bernie Sanders, we need more leaders. In those days, there were so many charismatic, insightful leaders who everybody knew. You didn't have to be a feminist to know who Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug were. You know, they were there. Their message was constant. You know, same with civil rights. And there were so many different leaders and articulate speakers. So we need more people coming forward and more activists. And that's, you know, hopefully what this movie will foment, you know, that it's not just about going to the movies and having fun. I mean, it's a good movie. It's a really good movie. You don't have to be high to enjoy it, but it helps. But it's also about a lot of deeper things and about,
yep,
you know, the excitement. The movie ends with this rousing scene, and I hope this is not a spoiler, but it brings it to the present very rapidly, and it creates audience members as protesters. You're sitting there in the theater, and you're going, yes!
Well, that's a very you're a great cheerleader for the film. I mean, you know, and it's underlying principles, and you know.
Well, I have a few quibbles with it. Not John and Jetty's editorial point of view, but they emphasize opinions by some of the other Video Freaks that I wouldn't characterize as my opinions. In, mm-hmm, other words, there were 10 independently thinking people portrayed in this movie.
Can you?
And we don't all think the same thing.
Of course not. Of course not. I'm sure there were lots of very boisterous conversations. And look, can you mention the other folks? And are they all around still? Or
Chuck Kennedy has passed away a few years ago. David Quart, one of the first of the video freaks, mm-hmm. is in an extended care facility. I mean, we were together in the 60s and 70s, and now we're in our 60s and 70s.
Yes, of course. That was 40, 50 years ago.
Harry Teasdale is the editor of the Columbia paper in Columbia County, New York. Carol Von Tobel, his wife, who was one of the original freaks, works in a renal facility as a social worker. Mm-hmm. Bart Friedman is still making videos. Nancy Kane lives in California with Paul Krasner, her husband, actually.
Sure.
And she's a photographer and a writer. She has a book called Video Days. Davidson Giuliati lives in New York, Connecticut, Venice, and France, and runs something co-runs something called the Emily Harvey Foundation, which provides residences in Venice and has a gallery in New York. Ann Woodward was a nurse. She became an editor for Barbara Walters for several years, then became a nurse and returned now to her original days of being a painter and an artist. Whom am I forgetting? Mary Curtis Radcliffe lives in Berkeley, and she's also a very prolific artist.
Many of these video freaks will be at the screenings at the IFC Center opening March 9th and on Wednesday, and then, of course, through the weekend, there's going to be a handful of Q&As at a lot of the screenings. And there'll be filmmakers, Skip, and Mary Curtis Radcliffe, and over the weekend, filmmakers Skip, Davidson, Bart, Perry.
Oh, wonderful.
Everyone's going to be
still
at,
close
at various screenings.
More or less? I mean, you know, in the general sense.
Well, you know, we reorganized, and I've been very active as the administrator of the partnership now in creating events and, you know, having events and reasons to get together. When you go see the Video Freaks movie, you'll see that spirit and expression and deeper communications are not stopped by crackles in the audio or dropouts.
There you go.
And you feel people, you know, when you know, you're a casual interviewer who makes you feel comfortable, so and conversational. So when spirit is brought out and people are comfortable, then the audience feels that.
Right.
And that's much more important than technical quality. That was our point of view.
Well, thank
God. And that's
God.
Why filmmakers...
That's your point you're making.
That's why filmmakers held it against us. You know, even the early, the first indie filmmakers in the 70s resented us because we were disdainful. We didn't care. We weren't disdainful, but we didn't really care about craft as much as they do. You know, I mean, subsequently, I did learn that it's good that every photograph is a picture of light and that you need to have good framing and being in focus.
The video maker is someone who's experiencing the world around them, and that comes through in the footage. A filmmaker is capturing something. A video maker is experiencing something.
Okay.
With a camera in tow, I think is a one shorthand, and that feeling comes through in this footage.
Understood. Right.
So this is not ersatz shaky camera work like MTV. This is real shaky camera work. And you get the sense...
This is incompetence. This is not like...
Right. This is true incompetence. But, you know, you feel that a human being is holding the camera because the camera breathes and moves and looks.
Said,
it's a curious camera.
That's a great way of putting it, the curious camera. John, it's going to be in New York City, obviously, on Friday, as we keep saying, March the 9th.
Yes.
For at least a week, if not longer, we'll see. Are there other theatricals or at least
yes, a movie? Yes, I'm going to tell you right now. Okay, so this podcast is going to be on what day are we on in podcast world?
Well, I can sort of time it however it most helps. But so if you're going to do something a little earlier...
All right, well, no, it actually doesn't really make... It doesn't really matter now that I'm looking at my dates here.
It's going to be on for like ever.
Yeah.
IFC Center, starting March 9th in New York City. March 7th, March 9th, and March 10th at the Cinequest Film Festival in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
Northwest Film Forum in Seattle on March 13th.
No, it's March 13th through the 16th. I checked there.
Yeah, no, it's down here. It's
through,
listed.
It's not just 13th and 16th.
Okay, through.
Okay, 13th, 14th.
Starting on the 13th.
Maybe even the 15th.
Check out the website. Utah Film Center, March 15th.
Mm-hmm.
The Nickelodeon in Columbia, South Carolina on the 16th. And then it opens in San Francisco for a week, starting March 18th at the Roxy.
Great.
And it'll be in L.A.? It'll be in L.A.?
That's to be determined.
Cinefamily?
No, that's not okay. That's not final yet.
We'll
Upstate Films in Rhinebeck and Woodstock on March 25th and 26th.
That makes sense, of course.
Gateway Film Center in Columbus, Ohio. Is it okay that I'm listing these places?
I have no problem with it. It's all edited out. Teasing you. Well, just give me the name of the, give me the website again, just so
okay,
people
so
can find
people can see all the listings, and they'll be updated as they come in and are finalized on videofreaksfilm.com.
Okay, and I'll post as much of that as I possibly.
Great.
And, we'll make it as easy as possible for people if they're interested. We'll get clips for this, so I can put some audio from the clips in.
Oh, in Toronto, too. It's coming to Toronto. Great.
Oh, good. Very good. I saw it personally at BAM Cinema Fest almost a year ago.
Yep.
Not almost a year ago, June last.
Yeah,
summer.
Last June.
Yeah. So
look, it's really important for us. This New York screening is important for us. It's great to see young people in the audience, but New York and L.A. are really important screenings to us because these are still communication media centers,
right?
And TV people will come to see it. And we do still want to change television, even though there's 1,000 channels. No, perhaps there's probably more
and platforms.
Right.
Yeah.
There's thousands
but if you're,
on your computer. So we want to change the industrial
complex.
Complex. Yeah.
But if you are in between those two cities somewhere, we'd love you to. So,
yes,
so
lots
come
of
out.
Places.
There's going to be a lot of places we're trying to...
And it will be downloadable after the theatrical run.
Right,
so
right.
You'll always be able to see this movie forever.
And so loving.
Come to the theater in the meantime, because then you could see it on
and
the big screen.
And possibly meet some of the actual...
Yeah. Meet the video
original
freaks.
Folks that we went
yeah.
to. John, Skip, thank you both very much. It was a delight and
thank
a pleasure
you.
To meet and talk with you.
Adam, thank you. You're handsome.
Oh, thank you. So are you. We're going to go out for drinks. Tonight. There will be a second show I'm going to air later this week because there's two films coming out on Friday. One is directed by Adam Egoyan. It's called Remember. And this will be Adam's second visit to the podcast. And then the other segment is with another returning friend of the podcast, Ben Dickinson, who made a film that I saw called... It was called Creative Control. It's sort of an indie science fiction film. It's opening Friday thanks to Magnolia Pictures. So I'm going to post that show. The idea is to do it by Thursday. So that's the plan. So we'll be back in just a couple of days. Having said that, I will be at South by Southwest. I'm leaving Wednesday. And if you're going to be down there, if you're planning on being down there, I'm very easy to find. You know, there's a way to reach me through the website. If you go to the homepage, you'll see there's a link to send me an email. But you can also get through to me on Facebook or Twitter, please, by all means, if you're down there, and get in touch with me. It would be great to hear from you. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of great films this in the next week. I'll be there for 5 or 6 days. I plan to see quite a few things. And the other part is I, of course, will be hosting an event. And I'm even though I've got 3 panelists, I'm about to announce the 4th and final panelist by tomorrow. So I'll mention it on the next show, but just waiting for a confirmation for that, and then I can post it and blast everybody about it. But it's going to be on Sunday, the 13th of March, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 3 o'clock at the Austin Convention Center. The name of the event is called Indie Film and the Death of the Theatrical, where we're going to be talking about the evolution, I guess you could say, the ever-evolving theatrical, and how what best serves filmmakers, what best serves theaters, how can we make this work so theaters aren't lying empty and filmmakers do what's right for their films. And so joining me will be Tim League, who is the founder of Alamo Drafthouse Cinemas, as well as Drafthouse Films, a distributor of indie films. And he's also the founder of Fantastic Fest, which is a, you know, film festival. And he's down in Austin, and he's gonna. I've been wanting him on the show for years. I'm very excited. And so he'll be joining the panel. And then we're actually going to go back to the office and have a podcast one-on-one segment with him for eventual posting. And then also on this panel is Scott Glosserman, who I hope to refer to as a friend soon because he's a delightful man. And he is the founder of Gather Films, which is doing exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about, which is creating very tailored types of theatricals for independent films. And Scott will be joining me. And finally, a distributor of many micro-budget and smaller but very, very artful and beautiful films, president of and founder of Factory 25, Matt Grady. Matt has been on this podcast before, and I will welcome him back to the live event. And again, I will make an announcement about a fourth panelist who will more likely than not be of the female persuasion, since that was something very specifically that I really wanted to do. Anyway, so thank you for listening to this episode number 337 of the podcast. I'll be back again in just a couple of days with an extra bonus episode this week, episode number 338, again with Ben Dickinson and Adam McGoyan. So thanks for listening. And take care. We'll see you soon. Rickety Rocket was my favorite cartoon. After marriage, the honeymoon. I'll be damned, gag me with a spoon. Who loves Papa Alice the Goon? Ladies, let your body flow. Send a chill up your spine like an Eskimo. Here's a backstage pass to a funky show. Come give me a kiss under the mistletoe. Greg Nice, my life's like a fairy tale. Parker was a great big whale. I knew a fat girl who broke the scale. You won't tell yo, I won't tell yo. High intel, I must excel yo. Took a little test, I passed and failed. Brakes, huh, no need to hit them. Skins, you got them, I wanna get rid of them. Style. Funky rhyme or with a funky funky style. Funky funky rhyme with a funky funky style. I got a funky rhyme or with a funky funky style. Got out of my bed about 8. And then I called Greg Nice cause it wasn't too late to get some skins and come around the block. Cause man, my tip is harder than a rock.